Hello, everybody.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Literary Underground. We have a change of host tonight. It's Problem Child, your man Wiley Ransom, here to talk about some things music-related and whatnot. But we'll have some music coming for you right now for you to listen to. Hey guys, that was Breakfast Enthusiast by Muxmole, one of my favorites. Unfortunately, I was having a few issues with uploading more music tonight, but that's okay. We'll just talk it out, have some cool discussions. Fortunately, it's just me here at the moment, but we might have a few guests coming in later as far as people that we can talk to, maybe some callers, I don't know. Feel free to go call in at 805-856-2808. I'm down to, you know, fire off answers to questions you might have about me, myself, anything that Problem Child does if you don't know who Problem Child is. So we're going to look for some more music right now. Hopefully we can find some here.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, when I see the news faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I sang soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah. From the Kentucky coal mine to the California sun, hey, Bobby shares the secrets of my soul. Through all kinds of weather, through everything we've done, your Bobby, baby, kept me from the cold world. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, that's all that Bobby left me. But it's feeling good was easy alone when he sang the blues. Hey, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby.
Pretty good song now, wasn't it? And 7:09, we're just getting started up tonight. Hopefully I'll be able to find you some more stuff to listen to real soon. And some other material coming up. Stay tuned.
Meant, messing around.
Hi, how are y'all doing? I just found something pretty interesting that I read a little bit ago that I'd like to share with y'all. It's from a book called Here Comes Everybody by Clay Shirky. And it's just a little bit of something about networking that I thought was pretty interesting. And this is just the first chapter. Starts out, on an afternoon in late May 2006, a woman named Ivana left her phone in the back seat of a New York City cab. No surprise there. Hundreds of phones a year show up in the New York Taxi and Limousine Commission's office, and more than that are actually lost, since some unknown number are simply taken by the next passenger. That was the fate of Ivana's phone, a fairly expensive multifunction version called a Sidekick, which came with a screen, keyboard, and built-in camera. I have this phone, too. Sadly for her, the Sidekick was sole repository of much of the information for her upcoming wedding, from contact information for the catering company to the guest list. When she realized what she'd done, Ivana asked Evan Gutman, a friend who worked as a programmer, in the financial industry, to offer a reward for its return via an email message that would show up on the phone. Getting no response after a couple of days, she shelled out more than $300 to buy a new one. Ivana's phone company had stored copies of her information on its servers and transferred it to her new phone. Once she had the information on her new phone, she discovered that her original one had ended up in the hands of a girl in Queens. Ivana knew this because the girl was using it to take pictures of herself and her friends and email them around. The photos taken on her old phone had been transferred to her new one. Ivana and Evan couldn't be sure who had taken the phone from the cab, but they knew who had it now, or rather they had her picture and her email address. Evan immediately emailed Sasha explaining the situation. Excuse me, let me start back. I misread something. Ivana and Evan couldn't be sure who had taken the phone from the cab, but they knew who had it now, based on the email address and her picture, sashacrystal8905@aol.com. Evan immediately emailed Sasha explaining the situation and asking for the phone back. Sasha replied she wasn't stupid enough to return it, a view punctuated with racial invective saying that Evan's white ass didn't deserve it back. She inferred Evan and Ivana's race from pictures on the phone. Sasha is Hispanic. The back and forth went on for some time. During the conversation, Sasha said her brother had found it in the cab and given it to her. Evan continued to ask for it back on the grounds that Sasha knew who its rightful owner was. Sasha finally wrote that she and her boyfriend would meet Evan, saying in the spelling challenge manner of casual yours, "I got ball. This is my address, 108 20 37th Avenue, Corona. Come and do it. I am give you the Sidekick so I can hit you with it." Evan declined to go to the listed address because he assumed it was fake. It was. And because of the threatened violence. Instead, he decided to take the story public. He created a simple web page with Sasha's photos, a brief description of the events so far, with the stated rationale of delivering a lesson on etiquette of returning people's lost belongings, as he put it. He titled the page Stolen Sidekick, added to his personal website, and began telling his friends about what happened. The original page went up on June 6th, and in the first few hours it was up, Evan's friends and their friends forwarded it around the internet, attracting a growing amount of attention. Evan first updated the page later that day, noting that his friends had done some online detective work and found a page on MySpace, the social networking website that had photos of Sasha and a man they surmised was her boyfriend. Evan's second update provided more background on how the phone was lost and who had it now. His third update, later that afternoon, reported that an official officer from NYPD had seen the story and had written explaining how to file a claim with the police. That evening, two things happened. First, a man named Louis sent Evan an email saying that he was Sasha's brother and member of the military police. He said that Sasha had bought the phone from a cabbie. This story, as Evan pointed out on the webpage, directly contradicted Sasha's earlier account of her brother finding the phone. Lewis also told Evan to stop harassing Sasha, hinting violence if Evan didn't lay off. The other event that evening was that Evan's story appeared on Dig. Dig is a collaborative news website. Users suggest stories and other user rate them thumbs up or thumbs down. The Dig front page, like all newspaper front pages, is made up of stories that are both timely and important. Except on Dig's timeline is measured by how recently the story was added, and importance is measured by user votes rather than by the judgment of an editor. The front page of Dig gets millions of readers a day, and a lot of those readers took a look at the stolen sidekick page. The story clearly struck a nerve. Evan was getting 10 emails a minute from people asking about the phone, offering encouragement or volunteering to help. Everyone who has ever lost something feels a diffused sense of anger at whoever found and kept it. But this time it was personal, since Evan and everyone reading Stolen Sidekick now knew who had the phone and who had seen her insulting refusals to return it. When the barrier to returning something is high, we make peace with finders, keepers, losers, weepers. But when returning something becomes easier, our sympathies ebb. Finding a loose bill on the street is different from finding a wallet with an ID in it. And the case of the missing sidekick was even worse than a lost wallet. Using someone's own phone to refuse to return it to them crossed some barrier of acceptability in the eyes of many following the saga. And the taunts and threats from Sasha and her friends and family only added insult to injury. Evan, clearly energized by the response from his growing readership, continued posting and running commentary on his webpage. He wrote 40 updates in 10 days, accomplished by a growing frenzy of local and national media attention. There is a lot to update. He and the people tuning in posted more MySpace profiles of Sasha, her boyfriend Gordo, and her brother. Someone reading the Stolen Sidekick page figured out Sasha's full name and her address and drove by her house, later posting the video on the web for all to see. Members of Louis' military police unit wrote to inquire about allegations that an MP was threatening a civilian and promised to look into the matter. Evan also created a bulletin board for his readers, a place online where they could communicate with one another. The attempts to recover Ivana's phone. Or rather, he tried to create a bulletin board, but the first such service he selected simply couldn't cope with the crush of excited users all trying to log in at the same time. Seeing this, he selected a second bulletin board service, but that too crashed under the sudden shock of demand as he did the third. These kinds of failures sometimes called blah, blah, blah. He finally found a service that could accommodate thousands of people following the Sidekick saga. Those readers settled in, discussing every aspect of the events from general speculation about Sasha's moral compass to a forum inviting members of the military to ask about Louis, the MP, and his involvement in the events. As is usual with these kinds of communities, much of the conversation was off-topic. The military section of the bulletin board included conversation about whether Louis was taking sufficient care of the uniform he was wearing and the pictures Sasha has taken. Anyways, during this period, Sasha's family and friends kept communicating with Evan about the phone, offering several inconsistent stories. Her mom had bought the phone from someone. Sasha didn't have the phone. She had sold the phone. She would sell him the phone back for $100. Louis announced that they were going to sue for harassment. Her friends wrote in with more threatening emails. Evan and Ivana filed a report with the police, who classified the phone as lost rather than stolen property, meaning they would take no action. Several people in New York City government wrote in offering to help get the complaint amended, including a police officer who shared internal NYPD paperwork and explained how the complaint should have been handled. Possession of this paperwork almost got Evan arrested when he later tried to get the complaint reclassified. By this point, millions of readers were watching, and dozens of mainstream news outlets had covered the story. The public airing of the NYPD's refusal to treat this case as theft generated so many public complaints that the police later reversed their stand after dispatching two detectives to talk with Ivana, agreed to treat the phone as stolen rather than lost. Then on June 15th, members of the NYPD arrested Sasha, a 16-year-old from Corona, New York, and recovered the stolen sidekick, which they returned to its original owner, Ivana. As Sasha's mother memorably told a reporter the day her daughter was arrested, "I never in my life thought a phone was going to cause me so many problems." It wasn't the phone that caused the problems, though. It was the people at the other end of the phone, the people who had come together around Evan's page, who found the MySpace profiles and the family address and helped pressure the police department, all in a busy 10 days. And all of it leading to Sasha's arrest. Having achieved their stated goals of publicly calling out Sasha and retrieving the phone, Evan and Ivana declined to press charges, and Sasha was released. Ivani's winning went off without a hitch, and Evan, in light of his ability to gather a crowd, began getting freelance work doing PR. You know, I really think that's an interesting story, because I feel like most everyone has lost something and or been straight up had their stuff stolen. And, you know, it's kind of funny to see how as a community we can all work together to get to a common goal for just one person, just based on how, let's say a town would react to a theft, or a town would react to someone being, you know, mugged at night. It's so easy for us as a group to change the life of one person. It's just something interesting that, you know, to think about. And here up, I'm going to try to find some more music. I'm going to choose this one. I hope you all like it. I know I do. We'll be right back.
Hi, guys. Classic right there. All right. I have another little something I'm going to read for you, and I'm just going to start. Get right into it. Raising and training animals may be expensive, but what happens when we go down the evolutionary scale to the level of bacteria, viruses, and other microorganisms? Here we can harness life in its primitive forms just as we once harnessed the horse. Today, a new science based on this principle is rapidly emerging, and it promises to change the very nature of the industry as we know it. Our ancestors domesticated various plant and animal species in the prehistoric past, says biochemist Marvin J. Johnson of the University of Wisconsin. But microorganisms were not domesticated until very recently, primarily because man did not know of their existence. Today he does, and they are already used in large-scale production of vitamins, enzymes, antibiotics, citric acid, and other useful compounds. By the year 2000, if the pressure for food continues to intensify, biologists will be growing microorganisms for use as animal feed and eventually human food. At Uppsala University in Sweden, I had the opportunity to discuss this with Arne Tiselius, the Nobel Prize-winning biochemist who is now president of the Nobel Foundation itself. Is it conceivable, I asked, that one day we shall create, in effect, biological machines systems that can be used for productive purposes and will be composed of not of plastic or metal parts, but of living organisms? His answer was roundabout, but unequivocal. We are already there. The great future of industry will come from biology. In fact, one of the most striking things about the tremendous technological development of Japan since the war has been not only its shipbuilding, but its microbiology. Japan is now the greatest power in the world in industry based on microbiology. Much of what their food and food industry is based on processes in what bacteria are used. Now they produce all sorts of useful things. Amino acids, for example, in Sweden, everybody now talks about the need to strengthen our position in microbiology. I'm going to stop for a second and just say that this book came out a while ago because they're making estimates for 2000. And yeah, I'm not sure about the year, but it's just some interesting stuff. To think about, you know, and I'm gonna get back into it. You see, one need not to think in terms of bacteria and viruses alone. The industry processes in the general, the industrial processes in general are based on man-made processes. You make steel by reduction of iron ore with coal. Think of the plastic industries, artificial products made originally from petroleum, yet it is remarkable that even today, with the tremendous development of chemistry and chemical technology, there is no single foodstuff produced industrially which can compete with what farmers grow. Another pause. I'm not one to usually talk about this kind of stuff, but it's funny to hear them predicting this now and seeing what we're dealing with now with, you know, all the bees dying in Monsanto and bioengineered foods and stuff. They're kind of predicting this, but they didn't see where we would take it as far as capitalist views, as far as, you know, companies are trying to make money more than they care about the consumer. But I don't know. Interesting stuff. Making me pause and think about it. I'm going to keep going. In this field, and in great many fields, nature is far superior to man. Even the most advanced chemical engineers and researchers. Now, what is the consequence of that? When we gradually get to know how nature makes these things and when we can imitate nature, we will have processes of an entirely new kind. These will form the basis for industries of a new kind, a sort of biotechnical factory, a biological technology. The green plants make starch with the aid of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and the sun. This is an extremely efficient machine. The green leaf is a marvelous machine. We know a great deal more about it today than 2 or 3 years ago, but not enough to imitate it yet. There are many such machines in nature. Such processes, Tesselius continued, will be put to work. Rather than trying to synthesize products chemically, we will, in effect, grow them to specification. Heady! Like, some of this stuff is just way cool. And this is just a book I picked up off my bookshelf. Pretty nuts. The green plants that makes up, oh, I think I already read that. One might even conceive of biological components in machines and in computers. For example, it is quite obvious Tesselius, I'm pretty sure I'm saying that wrong, continued that computers so far are just bad imitations of our brains. Once we learn more about how the brain acts, I would be surprised if we cannot construct a sort of biological computer. Such a computer might have electronic components modeled after biological components in the real brain. And at some distant point in the future, it is conceivable that biological elements themselves might be a part of the machine. Precisely such ideas have led to Jean Forestier, the French economist and planner, to state flatly, man is on the path toward integrating living tissue in the process of physical mechanisms. We shall have in the near future machines constituted at one and the same time of metal and living substances. In the light of this, he says, the human body itself takes on new meaning. I'm going to keep going. Like the geography of the planet, the human body has until now represented a fixed point in human experience, a given. Today we are fast approaching the day when the body can no longer be regarded as fixed. Man will be able, within a reasonably short period, to redesign not merely individual bodies, but the entire human race. In 1962, Doctors J.D. Watson and F.H.C. Crick received the Nobel Prize for describing the DNA molecule. Since then, advances in genetics have come tripping over one another at rapid pace. Molecular biology is now about to explode from the laboratories. New genetic knowledge will permit New genetic knowledge will permit us to tinker with human heredity and manipulate the genes to create altogether new versions of man. One of the more fantastic possibilities is that man will be able to make biological carbon copies of himself through a process known as cloning. It will be possible to grow from the nucleus of an adult cell a new organism that has the same genetic characteristics of the person contributing the cell nucleus. The restulent human copy would start life with genetic endowment identical to that of the donor, although cultural differences might thereafter alter the personality or physical development of the clone. Cloning would make it possible for people to see themselves born anew, to fill the world with twins of themselves. Cloning would, among other things, provide us with simple empirical evidence to help us resolve once and for all the ancient controversy over nature versus nurture, or heredity versus environment. The solution of this problem through the determination of the role played by each would be one of the great milestones of human intellectual development. Whole libraries of philosophical speculation could by a single stroke be rendered irrelevant. An answer to this question would open the way for a speedy qualitative advances in psychology, moral philosophy, and a dozen other fields. But cloning could also create undreamed of complications for the race. There is a certain charm to the idea of Albert Einstein bequeathing copies of himself to posterity. But what of Adolf Hitler? Should there be laws to regulate cloning? Nobel laureate Joshua Lederberg, a scientist who takes his social responsibility very seriously, believes it conceivable that those most likely to replicate themselves will be those who are most narcissistic, obviously. And that the clones they produce will also be narcissists. Even if narcissism, however, is culturally rather than biologically transmitted, there are other eerie difficulties. Thus, Lederberg raises a question as to whether human cloning, if permitted, might not go critical. I use that phrase he told me in almost exactly the same way that is involved in nuclear energy. It will go critical if there is a sufficient positive advantage to doing so. This has to do with whether the efficiency of communication, particularly along educational lines, is increased as between identical genotypes or not. The similarity of neurological hardware might make it easier for the identical copies to transmit technical and other insights from one generation to the next. Whew. I would have to say this is some deep stuff. But that's where I'm going to leave you guys for tonight. I'm going to have to... I will keep reading a little bit because I'm so enthralled. How close is cloning? It has already been done in amphibia, says Lederberg, and somebody may be doing it right now with mammals. It wouldn't surprise me if it comes out any day now when someone will have the courage to try it on a man. I haven't the froggiest idea, but I put the time scale on that anywhere from 0 to 15 years from now, within 15 years. During those same 15 years, scientists will also learn how the various organs of the body developed, and they will no doubt begin to experiment with various means of modifying them, says Lederberg. Things like the size of the brain, certain sensory qualities of the brain are going to be brought under direct developmental control. I think this is very near. It is important for laymen to understand that Lederberg is by no means a lone warrior in the scientific community. His fears about the biological revolution are shared by many of his colleagues. The ethical, moral, and political questions raised by the new biology simply boggle the mind. Who shall live and who shall die? What is man? Who shall control research in these fields? How shall new findings be applied? Might we not unleash horrors from which man is totally unprepared? In the option of many of the world's leading scientists, the clock is ticking for a biological Hiroshima. Imagine, for example, the implications of biological breakthroughs in what might be termed birth technology. Dr. E.S.E. Hafez, an internationally respected biologist at Washington State University, has publicly suggested on the basis of his own astonishing work on reproduction that within a mere 10 to 15 years, a woman will be able to buy a tiny frozen embryo, take it to her doctor, and have it implanted into her uterus. We're there. This book must be from, like, a while ago. Holy crap. It's just kind of funny. I'm really curious. To Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. Let's see. Let's find out when this is from. Ooh, wow. 1970. Yeah. And then
Yeah, this is really old. This is 1970s predictions are pretty spot on. Pretty spot on, I'd have to say. Let's continue. I stopped it, have it implanted in your uterus and carry it for 9 months and then give birth to it as though it had been conceived in her own body. The embryo, in effect, would be sold with a guarantee that the resultant baby would be free of genetic defect. The purchaser would also be told in advance the color of the baby's eyes and hair, its sex, and probable size at maturity, and probable IQ. All right. Hold on, people. Gotta make a move. Sorry about the pauses, all, but had to plug in the laptop, otherwise that would have been cut off. All right. Indeed, it would be possible at some point to do away with the female uterus altogether. Babies will be conceived, nurtured, and raised to maturity outside the human body. It is clearly only a matter of years before the work begun by Dr. Daniel Petrucci in the UK and other scientists in the United States and Soviet Union make it possible for women to have babies without discomfort of pregnancy. The potential applications of such discoveries raise memories of Brave New World and astounding science fiction. Thus, Dr. Hafez, in a sweep of his imagination, suggests that fertilized human eggs might be useful in the colonization of other planets. Instead of shipping adults to Mars, we could ship a shoebox full of cells, grow them into entire city-sized populations of humans. When you consider how much it costs to in fuel to lift every pound off the launch pad, Dr. Hafez observes, why send full-grown men and women aboard spaceships? Instead, why not ship tiny embryos in the care of competent biologists? We miniaturize other spacecraft components. Why not the passengers? Long before such developments occur in outer space, however, the impact of new birth technology will strike home on Earth, splintering our traditional notions of sexuality, motherhood, love, child rearing, and education. Discussions about the future of the family that deal only with the pill overlook the biological witch's brew now seething in the laboratories. The moral and emotional choices that will confront us in coming decades are mind-staggering. A fierce controversy is already raging today among biologists over the problem of and ethical issues arising out of eugenics. Should we try to breed a better race? If so, exactly what is better, and who is to decide? Such questions are not entirely new, yet the techniques soon to be available smash the traditional limits of the argument. We can now imagine marking the human race not as a farmer slowly and laboriously breeds up his herd, but as an artist might employing a brilliant range of unfamiliar colors, shapes, and forms. Not far from Route 80, outside a little town of Hazard, Kentucky, is a place picturesquely known as Valley of Troublesome Creek. Excuse me. In this tiny backwoods community lives a family whose members for generations have been marked by a strange anomaly, blue skin. According to Dr. Madison Cowan of the University of Kentucky College of Medicine, who tracked the family down and traced its story, the blue-skinned people seem perfectly normal,
in other respects, their unusual color is caused by a rare enzyme deficiency that has been passed from one generation to the next. Given our new fast accumulating knowledge of genetics, we shall be able to breed a whole new races of blue people, or for that matter, green, purple, or orange. In a world still suffering from the more or less lesion of racism, this is a thought to be conjured with. Should we strive for a world in which all people share the same skin color? If we want that, we shall no doubt have the technical means for bringing it about. Or should we instead work toward even greater diversity than now exists? What happens to the entire concept of race, to standards of physical beauty, to notions of superiority or inferiority? We are hurtling towards the time when we will be able to breed with both super and sub-races, as Theodore J. Gordon put it, in the future. Given the ability to tailor the race, I wonder if we would create all men equal, or would we choose to manufacture apartheid? Might the races of the future be a superior group, the DNA controllers, the humble servants, special athletes for the games, research scientists with 200 IQ and diminutive bodies? We shall have the power to produce races of morons or of mathematical savants. And stopping with that, I think I'm going to call the show quits for tonight. But it was good having y'all come in and listen, and got to read some interesting speculation from the 70s and some interesting things about networking, a few songs here and there. But it was fun being on the show, and I'll hear back from myself real soon.